the little boy who drowned in the lake. My aunt is someone, and I am no one. I have no friends here. How easy it would be to say that I simply left, ran away in the night. No one would raise a fuss. Maud might ask questions, but Mrs. Warren would swear to have seen me leave, I'm sure of it. If she chooses to, she can simply lock the door and throw away the key, and there would be nothing I could do. I sank to my knees by the window, the moonlight flooding the room, and I put my hands to my face, feeling the wetness of tears and the cool hardness of the ring I still wear, my mother's engagement ring. It's a diamond, just a very small one. And as I knelt there in the moonlight, something came to me, a desire to leave a mark, however small, something she cannot erase, no matter what she does to me. I took off the ring, and very slowly I scratched upon the glass, watching the moonlight illuminate the letters like white fire. Help me.
Chapter 26. Up in her room, Hal lay flat on her back, her forearm flung over her eyes to shut out the moonlight, and she could not sleep. It was not just the moonlight, painfully bright through the thin curtains. It was not even the reading that weighed upon her, or not only the reading. It was everything. Abel's expression as he fled, Edward's exasperation, Mitzi's whispered remarks as she held Hal close. The deed of variation. The thought of it was like a noose around Hal's neck, not yet tight, but slowly tightening, and already making it hard to breathe. When she had suggested it, it seemed like such a simple solution. She would refuse the bequest, melt away back to Brighton, disappear out of their lives. But Mitzi's last words, so kindly meant, made it clear that that was never going to happen. Even if she renounced this legacy, she would still be trapped in a web of bureaucracy and forms and ID. This tangle of family loyalties and resentments dragging her under as it had the others. But what could she do? The only way out of it was to admit to her fraud. Hal sighed and turned from her back onto her front, pressing her face into the crisp white pillowcase to try to get away from the moonlight that pierced the thin curtains. It cast long dark shadows of the bars across the bed, and as she shut her eyes she had a sudden jolting image of herself as she would look to someone standing across the room. Like the girl from the Ten of Swords. Betrayal, backstabbing, defeat. A prickle of fear ran through her, and suddenly Hal could no longer bear to lie still. She sat up, shivering in the cold, and then got out of bed and paced to the window. There she stood, looking out through the bars across the moonlit landscape. It looked so different by night. The emerald greens and rain-washed blues were turned to a thousand shades of black, the moonlight serving only to cast long, warped shadows that, without her glasses, made familiar shapes blurred and strange. Even the sounds were different. The roar of the occasional car along the coast road had gone, the cawing of the magpies had fallen silent, and all Hal could hear was the far-off crash of the waves and the hoot of an owl hunting. Hal closed her fingers on the window bars and rested her forehead on the glass, wishing, wishing she were 100 miles away at home in Brighton, out of this nightmare tangle of lies and guesses. Help me. The letters stood out clear and bright in the moonlight, and Hal suddenly knew without a shadow of a doubt that they had been scratched on just such a night as this, by someone even more desperate than her. Perhaps this other girl had not been as lucky. Perhaps for her the shackles had been not just emotional but literal. Perhaps she had sat here, looking out over the frosty lawn, wondering how, or even if, she could escape. Well, Hal was not trapped. Not yet. There was still time. As quietly as she could, she pulled off her pajamas and got back into her jeans, top, and hooded sweater. Then she dragged her case out from under the bed, lifting it so that it made as little noise as possible on the bare boards. Her spare clothes were already inside, neatly divided into clean and worn. Aside from that, there was only her wash bag, book, and laptop to pack. Hal's hands were trembling as she zipped up the case. Was she really going to do this? "You owe them nothing," she told herself. "You've taken nothing. Not yet." And after all, what was the worst they could do? They had her address, but it didn't seem likely she would be able to stay there for long. Not now Mr. Smith's minders had tracked her down. Perhaps the best thing to do would be to disappear completely. Simply scoop up her things, the most important papers, her mother's photographs, and walk away into a new life. There were other towns, other peers. The idea of starting again was frightening, and Hal thought of the huddled bodies on the pavements in Brighton. People just like her who had taken a leap and slipped, falling between the cracks to end up homeless and friendless and alone. It was a risk, a real risk. Hal had no safety net, and if she fell, there was no one to catch her. For a moment, Mr. Tresick had seemed to promise a very different existence, one with savings and safety and security. But that moment, that promise, had gone. And whether it was Mitzi's words to her today or the scratches on the windowpane, something inside Hal had crystallized into a cold, hard realization. She had to get away. Everything was packed, almost. The final thing Hal did was to settle her glasses on her nose and pick up her tarot cards, shoving the tin into her back pocket. Then she turned the handle of the door and pushed. Nothing happened. Hal felt her breath catch in her throat, and her heart seemed suddenly to be beating painfully hard. The bolts on the outside. But no, it wasn't possible. She would have heard. Surely she would have heard. And who? Why? A fluttering panic rose up inside her. Forcing herself to breathe slowly and steadily, Hal set the case quietly on the floor, wiped her sweating palms on the back pockets of her jeans, and tried again. The handle was turning, but the door still didn't open to her shove. It was bowing at the top, but stuck at the bottom. Hal's breath was coming quicker now, but she made herself slow down, think rationally. "There's no reason for anyone to lock you in. You're only panicking because you saw the bolts. Yesterday this wouldn't even have occurred to you. Remember what Mrs. Warren said, damp makes the frame swell." Taking a deep breath, she turned the door handle and pushed until a crack appeared around the edge. Then she put her foot against the part that was still sticking and leaned slow and steady with as much force as she dared, trying not to make any sudden movements that might wake the sleepers below. There was a long, protesting creak, and then the door gave with a
bang that sent Hal stumbling forward, her hand over her mouth. She waited for the protesting voices, the sound of feet on the stairs. But nothing happened. And at last, she plucked up the courage to pick up her case and tiptoe out. As she left the bare little room, she could not stop herself looking back at the door, checking to see if... But no. She was being paranoid. The bolts were drawn back, undamaged. It was just as Mrs. Warren had said, the damp and nothing more. Still, though, the kind of house that had locks on the outside of the doors was not one Hal wanted to sleep in any longer. Holding the case in front of her like a shield so that she could fit down the narrow flight, she went as quietly and quickly as she could to the hallway below, and from there down the long, curving staircase to the ground floor, and freedom. 13th of December, 1994. I have to get away. I have to get away. The words I scratched on the window are like a taunt now, an admission of defeat. Because no one is going to help me except myself. It is 3 days since I was locked in here, and apart from a hurried, whispered conversation with Maud, I have seen no one except my aunt. She brings up trays at odd times, and sometimes not at all, leaving me terrified and hungry. And always, always the same question. Who is he? Who is he? Who is he? Today, when I shook my head, she hit me again, so that my head snapped back with such a force that I heard my neck crunch, and the hot flare on my cheekbone blossomed across my face and into my ear, making it ring with pain. I staggered backwards into the bed frame and looked up at her, holding on to the metal with one hand, the other pressed to my face as if to hold the bones together. For a moment she looked almost frightened. Not of me, but of what she had done, what she might have done. She had, I think, lost control, perhaps for the first time since I had known her. Then she turned on her heel and left, and I heard the scraping of the bolts before she clattered down the stairs. I sank down on the bed. My hands were shaking and I felt a wave of cramps in my stomach, followed by a wash of sickness. At first I thought I might be losing the baby, but I sat quietly, waiting, and the pain subsided, though the heat in my cheek and the screech of tinnitus in my ear remained. I wanted to write in my diary, to do as I always do when things get too much, let it out onto the page like a kind of bloodletting, letting the ink and paper soak up all the grief and anger and fear until I can cope again. But when I got the book out of its hiding place under the loose board, I looked at it with fresh eyes. I can't tell her the truth. Not just because if I do, I will never see him again, but because I am seriously beginning to fear that if I do, she may kill me for real. And for the first time after today, I truly think she is capable of it. She can't make me tell her, but if she searches my room, she doesn't need to. It's all here. So after I've finished this entry, I'm going to make a fire. And then I'm going to rip out every single page about him, score out his name, tear out every reference, and burn them. Because whatever she does to me, she can't make me confess. I just have to hold on until I've seen him, and after that we'll decide what we do together. Somehow I will get word to him. I can pass a letter to Maud, perhaps. After all, I have paper here and pens, and I can trust her At least I hope I can. He will come when he gets that letter, surely. He'll come. He has to. And then we'll go somewhere, run away, together. We'll figure it out. I just have to hold on to that thought. I just have to hold on.
Chapter 27. The stairs creaked painfully as Hal made her way down, holding her breath at every sound, at the screech of an owl hunting in the garden, at the drip, drip of a far-off tap. At last, she reached the passageway on the ground floor, and holding her suitcase rather than risk the rattling wheels, she tiptoed as quietly as she could towards the entrance hall, where the glass panes above the door cast moon-bright crescents on the panels opposite. The door was bolted, top and bottom, and Hal struggled with the stiff fastenings, but after what seemed like a silent, trembling age, she worked them out of the shafts and turned the door handle. It was locked, and there was no key. Hal looked around the entrance hall, beneath the silver salver that held letters and bills, behind the dusty vase of dried flowers, on the lintel of the door. No key. No key. Her heart was beating fast now. Leaving had become, instead of a longing, an imperative. If she were found here now, stealing out of the house like a thief in the night, it was quite likely someone would call the police. But it no longer mattered. The only thing that mattered was getting away. Hal scanned the hallway, and then picked up the case and retreated into the drawing room. The tall windows in there were closed and shuttered, but on the inside, and after a long moment of struggling with the bar, it gave with a sudden thump, and the shutter swung open. Behind it, the window itself was fastened with just a simple latch, and Hal lifted it, her heart racing with a mix of relief and anticipation. The panes opened inwards, into the room, letting in a gust of frosty air, and she peered out into the night, making sure that she was not about to step out into a 6-foot drop. There was a drop, but only a couple of feet, to the veranda below, and she carefully lowered her case out, and then dropped to her knees to clamber out herself. She was halfway there, one leg over the sill, when a voice spoke from the darkness of the other end of the room.
"That's right. Sneak away in the night, coward."
Hal's head shot up, her blood suddenly racing with fear. "Who's there?" she demanded, the fright making her voice more aggressive than she had meant. But the speaker at the other end of the room only laughed and walked into the shaft of moonlight. In truth, Hal hadn't really needed to ask. She had known who it was. Who else would be prowling so silently through the darkened rooms in the middle of the night? Mrs. Warren.
"You can't stop me," Hal said.
She put her chin up defiantly.
"I'm going." "Who said I'm stopping you?"
Mrs. Warren said. Her lip was curled, and there was a kind of scornful laugh in her voice.
"I told you to leave once, and I'll say it again. Good riddance. Good riddance to you and your trash mother before you."
"How dare you?" Hal found her voice was shaking, not with fear, but with anger.
"What do you know about my mother?"
"More than you,"
Mrs. Warren said. She leaned towards Hal, her voice full of a venom that made Hal shrink back.
"Little milk and water coward. She was a conniving little gold digger just like you."
Hal scrambled backwards out of the window and staggered to her knees.
She was so angry she felt a ringing in her ears, a kind of hissing fury. It was a mixture of fury and shock.
Don't you dare talk about my mother that way. You don't know what she went through to bring me up. Don't talk to me about what you don't know anything about.
Mrs. Warren spat.
Get out. You should never have come back here.
With that, she swung the window shut so that Hal had to snatch her fingers out of the way just before the heavy frame banged to. She caught a glimpse of a face filled with a poisonous hate, and then the shutter slammed closed too, and she heard the bang and scrape of the bar being pulled across. Hal stood for a moment, her heart beating hard in her chest. She found her arms were wrapped around herself as if trying to shield herself from something, though from what she didn't know. As her heart slowed, she let her arms drop to her side and forced herself to breathe slowly and more deeply. Thank God! Thank God she was out of that horrible house and away from that horrible woman. Let them write. Let them come after her for all she cared. They couldn't make her return. They couldn't make her show them anything. She could move, change addresses, change her name, if that was what it took. About one thing, Mrs. Warren was right, she thought, as she picked up the case and began the long walk down the drive to the main road to try to hitch a lift to Penzance. She should never have come. It was only later, much later, after a lift in an HGV on its way to St. Ives, and a lecture from the lorry driver about personal safety, when she was huddled in the doorway of Penzance Station, her coat around her, waiting for the doors to open and the first train to London to arrive, that she had time to reflect on Mrs. Warren's words, to unpick the realization beneath the hissed invective.
Conniving little gold digger. Good riddance to you, and your trash mother before you.
Those words could mean only one thing. Mrs. Warren knew. She knew the truth. She knew that Hal's mother was not Mrs. Westaway's daughter, but the dark-eyed cuckoo cousin, taken in as an orphan. And she knew, therefore, that Hal herself was an impostor. But she had said nothing. Why? The puzzle had been in the back of Hal's mind since last night, twisting and turning in her imagination, shaping and morphing into a dozen different possibilities. But it was only when the doors of the station opened and Hal rose stiffly, stretching out her chilled, cramped limbs and trying to smile at the station attendant, that Mrs. Warren's last words spoke again inside her head like a bitter echo. She should never have come. That was right. But it wasn't quite what Mrs. Warren had said. What she had said was, you should never have come back. Chapter 28. The words stayed with Hal, niggling at her on the long journey back to London. Come back. What had she meant? Was it a slip of the tongue? Was it possible that she had been to Trepassen as a child, too young to remember? But if so, Mrs. Warren must know full well the truth about her mother, in which case why had she not said nothing? Was she hiding something of her own? Suddenly, Hal longed to be back in Brighton. Not just to be home, but to look through the documents beneath her bed. There was so much in there that she had never looked at. Boxes of papers and old letters, diaries, postcards. Things Hal had found too painful to read after her mother's death, but that she could not bear to throw away.
She had bundled them up and stored them out of sight and out of mind, ready for a day when she would have a reason to go through them. And now, that day had come. For Hal was sure of one thing. Her mother did have a connection to that house. And so did Hal. She was not Mrs. Westway's granddaughter, that was certain, but she was a relation. And if her mother was connected to that place, so was she. And she was determined to find out what that connection was. It was the middle of the afternoon when Hal reached her flat, footsore from carrying her case all the way from Brighton Station. She had no money for a cab and her bus pass had expired. As she drew closer to Marine View Villas, she found her heart was thumping hard in her chest, and not just from the long walk. Words hissed in her ear in time with her footsteps.
Broken teeth. Broken bones.
Stop it! She said the words aloud, crossing the road, and a boy of about 15 looked sourly round at her.
I'm 18, innit? You can't tell me what to do!
Hal shook her head, wanting to tell him that whatever he'd been talking about, it didn't matter to her. But he was gone, and she was turning into her road, her heart going at a sickening rate now. When she got to the narrow front door, there was no sign that it had been forced, but instead of unlocking it, she rang the bell for the ground floor flat. The man who answered it looked surprised, as well he might. Hal had never seen him before.
Yes, can I help?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hal felt discomforted. She had been planning to ask Jeremy, who lived here, to accompany her up to her flat. I didn't realise. Is Jeremy here?
Is he the guy who lived here before? I don't know. I only just moved in this week. Are you a friend of his?
Yes. No, not really, Hal said. She hitched her case up, feeling her feet aching. I live here. Upstairs.
Oh, right. Well, remember your key next time, eh? I was having a kip.
I've got my key, Hal said. It's not that. I just wondered. Look, you haven't seen anyone hanging around here, have you? A bald man, bouncer type?
Don't think so,
the man said briefly. He had lost interest now and had retreated back to his own front door, plainly wanting to get back to his bed.
X, is he?
No. Hal shifted her grip on the case, wondering how honest she could be. No, I owe him some money, actually, and he's not been very understanding.
Ooh.
The guy held up his hands, showing Hal his palms, really backing away now.
Look, I'm not getting mixed up in that, love. Your money, your business.
I'm not asking you to get mixed up, Hal said crossly. I just want to know, did you see anyone?
No,
the man said, and he closed his flat door in her face. Hal shrugged and sighed. It was not very reassuring, but it was as good as she was going to get. As she climbed the stairs to her attic flat, she held her suitcase in front of her like a shield, and the image came to her, fresh and sharp, of that narrow staircase back in Cornwall, and a girl disappearing upstairs into darkness. When she shivered, it was not entirely at the thought of what might be waiting upstairs. At the top, she paused, trying to still her breathing, listening for any sound behind her front door. It was shut and locked, and showed no signs of being forced, but then it had looked okay last time, too. Clearly, they had got in once, they could do so again. When she bent and peered beneath the door, only a cool breeze blew in her face. There was no sign of any movement showing through the narrow crack, no feet standing silently behind the door. At last, holding her phone like a weapon, her finger poised over the 9, she put her key into the lock as silently as she could, and then twisted and opened it with one swift movement. K. kicking the door hard back against the wall of the living room with a bang that echoed in the quiet hallway. The room stood empty, silent, the only sound Hal's pounding heart. No feet came running. Nevertheless, she didn't put down her phone until she had checked every nook and cranny, from the bathroom to her wardrobe, right down to the alcove behind the living room door where she kept the Hoover. Then, and only then, did her heart begin to slow, and she shut the door, drawing the chain and bolt across, and let herself sink down on the sofa to rub her shaking hands over her face. She could not stay here, that much was obvious. Hal rarely cried, but as she sat there, on the worn old sofa that she had jumped on as a child, in front of the cold gas fire her mother had lit so many afternoons after school, she felt her throat close with unshed tears, and a few self-pitying drops trace down her nose. But then she took a deep breath and scrubbed them away. This wouldn't do. It wouldn't help. She had to move on. But before she did, she needed to find the truth. The answers to the questions she had been asking herself ever since Mr. Trezick's letter had come through. She was sick of lies and lying. It was time for the truth. Hal's stomach was rumbling, so she made herself a piece of toast and took it through into her bedroom. Then she pulled the box out from under the bed, tipped the contents upside down onto the rug, and began to sift through. Upended like this, the first pieces of paper were the oldest, expired passports, exam certificates, old letters, photographs. Though the dates were jumbled, the contents moved from drawer to drawer too many times to be strictly chronologically ordered. Hal opened an envelope at random, but it was nothing very interesting, just some of her mother's old bank statements. Beneath it, there was a sheaf of baby photographs, herself, presumably, about 6 months old, smiling up at an unseen photographer. Another envelope contained the original rent contract for the flat, the ink faded, the staple in the corner beginning to rust. It was dated January 1995, a few months before Hal's birth. £60 a week, her mother had agreed. It seemed impossibly low even back then, and Hal thought she might almost have laughed had she not been so close to tears. She couldn't do that. She couldn't give way to self-pity. Tomorrow, she would make a plan, find somewhere to go, but in the meantime, she had to focus on the task at hand. She could not take all this with her. She'd have enough to do with packing her clothes and other essentials. So then, a pile for stuff that could be recycled, and for the stuff she needed to keep, she could make one pile for personal papers relating to her mother, a pile for the flat, a pile of essentials, passports, birth certificates, anything that she might need to start her new life. And then finally on the bed, she would put anything related to Cornwall and Trepasson House, however tangentially. Perhaps there would be something there, some connection to the Westaways that would give her the foothold she needed to get out of this mess. The first thing to go on the bed was a postcard. The side for writing was blank, but the picture, when she turned it over, made Hal sit up. It featured Penzance. She recognised the harbour. The postcard was divided into four quarters, with Penzance on the bottom left, St. Michael's Mount on the top right, and two photographs of unidentified headland that Hal didn't recognise on the other sections. The link might be a slim one, but it was evidence, however thin. But what really made Hal's heart miss a beat were letters, a sheaf of them tied up with string. They were addressed to Margarita Westaway at an address in Brighton Hal didn't recognise, and the postmark was Penzance. Hal peered inside the first one, but there was no return address, and the ink was so faded she had trouble making out the words. "I am writing via Lizzie," something Hal couldn't make out. "Please don't worry about the deposit. I have a little money left from my parents, and beyond that, I'll... oh, God, I don't know. I'll tell fortunes on Brighton Pier, or read palms on the seafront. Anything to get away." There were more, several more, but it would take her hours to go through them and decipher the crabbed, faded writing. Resolutely, she put them on the bed and carried on sifting. She was only halfway down the box when she came across something wrapped in an old tea towel. It felt like a book. Hal frowned and picked it up, but the thing unravelled and into her lap fell, yes, a book, but not a printed book, a diary. Gently, Hal picked it up and began to leaf through the pages. Great chunks had been ripped out, frayed stubs of paper, all that was left of their existence, and the pages that were left were hanging by a thread, unanchored by the loss of their neighbours. The first whole entry was one towards the end of November, but judging by where it came in the book, Hal thought that the diary itself must have been started in October or September, perhaps even earlier. Only fragments of those months remained, though. The rest of the pages, less than half by Hal's estimate, were thickly covered with writing, but even there sections were scrawled out, names erased, whole paragraphs scratched out. The entries came to an end on the 13th of December, and after that the pages were whole, but blank. Only one single page, right at the end of the diary, had been removed. It was as if the diarist had simply stopped. Hal leafed slowly back to the beginning, past fragments of text, running her fingers over the thickly scored-out sections. Who had done this? Was it the writer of the diary, or someone else, scared of what evidence might be found within its pages? And more to the point, whose diary was it? The writing looked a little like her mother's, but an immature, unformed version, and there was no name inside the front cover. At last she came to the first whole section and began to read. "The 29th of November, 1994, Hal read, frowning to make out the faint, discoloured letters, the scrawling hand. "The magpies are back." Chapter 29. It was almost dark when Hal finally looked up from the papers, and she realised, blinking, how the light had faded, so that she had been squinting to make out the letters on the torn and butchered pages. But at last she knew. She had the answers she had been looking for, or some of them, at least. The writer of the diary was Hal's mother, and she was pregnant. With Hal herself, it must be. The dates matched exactly. Hal had been born just 5 months after the final entry. But as she walked through to the living room, switching the light on as she went, she was thinking back over what she had read. She turned on the kettle, and while it came to the boil, she leafed back through the fragile pages until she came to the entry she was looking for, the one dated the 6th of December. And as she reread it, a cold certainty hardened in Hal's stomach. Her mother had known who her father was. And not just that, Hal had been conceived there, at Trepassen. Everything her mother had told her, the story about the Spanish student, the one-night stand, it had all been lies. In so many ways, the diary explained everything. The mix-up with the names, the reason Mrs. Westaway had never told Mr. Trezick about a black sheep cousin with the same name as her own daughter. She had cut her niece off, a disgrace to the family, and no one had spoken of her again. But in other ways, it explained nothing. Why had her mother lied? And who was her father? If only, Hal found herself thinking, as she flicked through the torn, disintegrating pages, if only you hadn't destroyed his name, everything about him. Why? So often she had heard her mother's voice inside her head, lecturing, admonishing, encouraging. But now, when she needed her most, her voice was silent. Why? Hal said aloud, hearing the despair in her own voice, the way the single word echoed in the silent flat. Why? Why did you do it? It was a cry for help, but there was no answer. Only the imperceptible ticking of the clock and the crackle as her fingers tightened on the diary in her hand. The symbolism was painfully obvious. If there is an answer, Hal, it's in your hands. She could almost hear her mother's voice, a little mocking. And she felt rage flood her at having the truth dangled in front of her and then snatched away, just as the legacy had shimmered there like a beautiful mirage for a moment before disappearing into nothingness. But the answer was not there. If it was, it lay in the torn-out sections. Even in the passages that remained, her mother had blacked out names and paragraphs. And she had no time. She had to leave tomorrow before Mr. Smith's men noticed that the girl they were hunting was back. Slow down. Her mother's voice again, softer this time. Think clearly. Slow down? She wanted to shout. I can't slow down. More haste, less speed. Very well, then. She had to puzzle this out slowly and logically. There could not be that many suspects. Who could have been at Trepassen that long summer? The brothers? The entry of the 6th of December was still open on her lap, describing the night her mother assumed she had conceived. Hal read it through again, and this time she stopped at one phrase. Our eyes met, blue and dark. Hal's mother had dark eyes like her own, which meant that whoever she'd slept with must have been a blue-eyed man. Ezra had dark eyes, uncompromisingly so. Abel, well, that was more difficult. He was fair, but his eyes... Hal shut her own, trying to remember. Greyish? Hazel? Blue eyes could look grey in the right light, but try as she might, she could not picture Abel's kind, bearded face with blue eyes, nor could she imagine him in her mother's arms. He would have said something, surely. In desperation, she pulled out the picture from her pocket, the one Abel had given her, taken the very afternoon that her mother had been writing about. There was Ezra, his dark head thrown back, laughing with an openness so at odds with his present-day cynicism that Hal thought her heart might break a little. His dark eyes just slits of merriment. There beside him was his twin, Maud, her fair hair cascading down her back. And there, too, was Abel, his dark blonde hair glinting in the sun. She peered closer, trying to make out his face beneath the faded colour and the frayed folds of age, as if she could see through the paper to the past and the people left behind. Could it be? Could she be Abel's child? In which case, She stopped, feeling something cold against the back of her neck, like a chilly hand laid there.
If she were Abel's daughter, the legacy might hold up. Was that why Mrs. Warren had said nothing? Because the legacy did belong to Hal.
The thought should have been a welcome one, but for some reason it made her feel like the bottom of her stomach had fallen away. Before she folded the picture up to put it away, she looked very deliberately at the fourth person in the frame, at the one whose eyes she had been avoiding, at her mother, her dark eyes uncompromising, staring out at her through the years. "What are you trying to say?" Hal thought desperately. She felt her hands close on the old fragile paper, the flecks of pigment disintegrating beneath her fingertips. "What are you trying to tell me?" It was as if her mother were looking out at her from the past, right at her. But no. Not at her. At... Hal's fingers were shaking as she put the photograph down very gently and began flicking back through the pages of the diary, back, no, too far, forward, and there at last, there it was. In the crumbling boathouse, Maud untied the rickety, flat-bottomed skiff, and we rowed out to the island. The lake water dappled and brown beneath the hull of the boat. Maud tied the boat to make a makeshift jetty and we climbed out. It was Maud who went in first, a flash of scarlet against the gold-brown waters as she dived, long and shallow, from the end of the rotting wooden platform. "Come on, Ed," she shouted, and he stood up, grinned at me, and then followed her to the water's edge and took a running jump. And then, just a few lines later...
"Take a photo,"
Maud said lazily, as she stretched her tanned limbs honey gold against the faded blue towel. "I want to remember today." He gave a groan, but he stood obediently and went to fetch his camera and set it up. I watched him as he stood behind it, adjusting the focus, fiddling with the lens cap. "Why so serious?" he said as he looked up, and I realized that I was frowning in concentration, trying to fix his face in my memory. Initially, Hal had imagined only four people in that scene: a mother, Maud, Ezra, and Abel, the four people in the photograph's frame. But it was not quite the truth. Someone must have been taking the picture, and it was the person her mother was looking at. The same person she had gone down to the beach with later that evening. Her lover. Hal's father. Hal stared at the photograph, meeting her mother's fierce, direct gaze. And for the first time, she read the intensity in those eyes as something else, not suspicion, not antagonism, but longing. Of all the people in the photograph, her mother was the one who stared directly at the photographer, challenging him, whoever he was, with her eyes, locking his gaze. Hal had read that look quite differently. She had seen the connection between her mother and the viewer as their own relationship, as if her mother were gazing out of the past at her. But now she understood. It was not she herself that her mother was looking at, for how could she? It was the photographer. It was Hal's father, Ed. Chapter 30. That night, Hal's bed had never felt softer or more welcoming. She slid between the covers and shut her eyes, but sleep didn't come.
It wasn't that she was not tired, she was, almost to the point of nausea. It wasn't even the thought of Mr. Smith's men. She had dragged a chest of drawers across the front door, and she didn't think that even they would come in the middle of the night, risking waking all her neighbours and the consequent 999 calls. What stopped her from sleeping was that every time she shut her eyes, she was back, between the pages of the diary and the claustrophobia of that little room. The picture was so vivid, the narrow attic, the barred windows, the two metal bolts, top and bottom. When she shut her eyes, they rose up in front of her mind's eye, as if she were back there herself, and she felt a kind of sick dread. Not just for her mother, who, after all, had escaped and made her way here to Brighton and made a life for herself and her child away from Trepasson, but for those other children, for Abel and Ezra, locked in that room as children as punishment for whatever childish misdeeds they'd committed. And most of all, for Maud. The first few times Hal had read the entries, she had been looking for her mother, trying to picture the person behind the words and compare them to her own memories. Then she had read it again, scouring it for mentions of the boy who might be her father. Ed. Edward? She found herself remembering that cool, handsome face, the appraising blue eyes, trying to pick out any features that might have belonged to her. "Come on, Ed." The words rang inside her head as though her mother had shouted them aloud in the little room. Ed. It was a common enough name. There must be dozens of Edwards, Edgars, and Edwins scattered around Cornwall. And yet, all evening she had gone round and round, combing for other mentions that might give evidence either way, arguing for and against, back and forth. But her mother had kept her word, and apart from that small slip, every reference to her father's name had been ripped out or scored through. Now, though, in the stillness of the night, as she went back again and again over words she had committed to memory, she found herself looking for mentions not of Ed, but of Maud. Her own mother was oddly shadowy. Perhaps it was because she spent so many of the entries describing others. But it was hard to match the uncertain, romantic girl writing this diary with the strong, practical woman she had become after years of single motherhood. Without the evidence of her own eyes, Hal could never have imagined her mother writing with such heat and yearning about a man. Perhaps this was the first and last time. But Maud was different somehow. Though she only flitted through the pages, she felt like a constant presence in the diary. And as the clock ticked past midnight and the rain spattered at the window, Hal found herself scouring her memory for references to Maud. It was not just the fact that it was Maud's legacy that she, Hal, had been handed on a plate. It was that there was something about her that spoke directly to Hal. Perhaps it was her fierce determination, her refusal to be quashed, her desire to break free. Perhaps it was her wry humour, or her generosity, for Maud's love and concern for her cousin ran like a thread of gold in the dark throughout the diary, and even across the gap of 20 years, Hal found herself smiling at her remarks. What was it she had said about the tarot cards? "Load of wafty BS." That was it. It was so close to what Hal sometimes found herself thinking when she met the more earnest practitioners that she had almost laughed aloud when she read it. But what had happened to her? To Maud? To the real Margarita? Where was she now? And why did no one talk about her? Was she dead? Or had she made good her vow to escape?
Perhaps she had disappeared abroad, changed her name, made a new life for herself. Hal hoped so, for Maud's own sake, but also because she knew the truth of what had happened in those torn-out pages. She knew the truth about Hal's mother and her father. Abel, Ezra, Harding, Mr. Trezick, thanks to Hal, they all believed that Maud had died in a car crash 3 hot summers ago. Only Hal knew the truth, that it was not Maud who had died, but Maggie, her cousin. It was possible, even probable, that Maud was still alive, still out there, still holding on to the truth of what had happened to her cousin and the secret of Hal's own identity. But to find her, Hal was going to have to go back. Back to Trepassen, where she could start again, pick up the threads of Maud's life from the beginning. And there was only one way that Hal could think of doing that. Chapter 31. The next day was Sunday. It was 8 when Hal dragged her duvet to the living room and curled up on the sofa with a cup of coffee in one hand and a pile of letters in her lap. On top of them was Harding's business card. She waited until 9:30 before she dialed the number, but it went through to voicemail, and she could not stop a small spurt of relief when she heard the smooth female voice of the automated message. "This is the voicemail box of..." And then, in Harding's own voice, slightly pompous and half a tone deeper than his natural register,
"Harding Westway?"
"Please leave a message after the tone," continued the woman, and there was a bleep. Hal coughed.
"Uncle Harding, it's Hal, Harriet. I am so sorry for running out yesterday, but the fact is..." She swallowed again. She had spent the time since getting up trying to decide what to say, and in the end she had decided there was only one thing she could say. Only one thing that made sense of her actions. The truth.
"The fact is, I've been pretty freaked out by all of this. Whatever I was expecting when I came down to Cornwall, it wasn't what Mr. Trezick read out. And I've found it very hard to come to terms with my grandmother's will. On Friday night, I couldn't sleep, and I'm afraid I just..." Beep.
And the message cut out, indicating that she had taken too long to explain herself. "To send the message, press 1. To re-record the message, press 2, said the female voice. Hal swore quietly, pressed 1, and then hung up and redialed. This time it went through to voicemail almost immediately.
"Sorry, I took too long and the message cut out. Look, the long and short of it is, I'm very sorry I left without talking to you first, but I've had some time to think, and I'd like to come back. Not just because I appreciate you probably need me present for the interview with Mr. Trezick, but also, well, I have a lot of questions about my mother and about why my grandmother chose to do this, and, well, that's it, really. I hope you'll forgive me. Please call me back on this number and let me know. Bye. And sorry, again."
When she put down the phone, she felt her stomach turn with a feeling halfway between nervousness and sickness. Was she mad to go back? Perhaps. But she could not stay here. Not with Mr. Smith's men waiting for her, and not without knowing the truth of her own past. If she burnt these bridges now, then she might never be able to find out what had happened at Trepassen, who her father really was. Why had her mother lied about her father's identity? Last night she had been too busy searching in the diary for answers, answers she had not found, but now The question was beginning to press upon her like a guilty secret, demanding her attention. For some reason, her mother had chosen not just to keep Hal in the dark about the identity of her own father, but to go further, to spin a whole tale of falsehoods. The Spanish student, the one-night stand. None of it had existed. But why? Why go to such lengths to keep Hal in the dark about something she had every right to know? Before she could unpack the conundrum any further, her phone buzzed against her leg, the shrill sound of the ringer following with a millisecond delay. She looked at the screen and her stomach flipped. Harding. Hello?
Harriet!
Harding's voice was full of a kind of hectoring relief.
I've just listened to your messages. Young lady, you gave everyone here a severe fright.
I know, Hal said. I'm sorry. She was sorry. Genuinely sorry. It's like I said in my message, I was overwhelmed by it.